Music Zettel with James Humberstone.
Welcome to Music Zettel, a podcast about engaging students in creative, pluralist music making, drawing on my own work as an academic, a teacher, and a composer and producer. I wanted to start off by thanking you all for your feedback on my AI poddy last week. It was a bit of a shame that it was also the week where I realised that in updating my website recently, that's at humberstone.org, in updating that website, I had somehow made the comments box disappear. So there was me confidently saying, please leave comments on my website and then I will be able to discuss your comments in the next podcast. So a bunch of you got back and said, wow, love that podcast. Thanks very much for it. And a few of you pointed out that you couldn't leave a comment. So this is just an invite, whether it's about last week's podcast or this week's or anything else in the series or something, you know, related but unrelated, I will try and get that comments box going again. I paid somebody to do the update on my website and I want to try and work out how to do it myself, but worst comes to the worst, I will just have to pay them to put it back. But you know, feel free to email me. My work email is all over the place, james.humberstone@sydney.edu.au. You can probably also find my personal email address all over the internet, james@composerhome.com. But it's the work one that I, because I have to keep an eye on it at least 5 days a week, that I will keep an eye on it. So feel free to drop me a question there or on socials. I'm not doing a lot of socials myself nowadays, but I hopefully will get notifications if you send me a message. And LinkedIn, because I am an old man, is the main place that I'm doing socials nowadays. So my apologies for that if you do much cooler socials. I do have a PhD student writing a PhD about TikTok and music education, but you know, I'm only cool by reflection of her brilliance. And that obviously should be a topic for another podcast. This week, I was about to sit down and record a podcast on the teaching resources that I made with a couple of my wonderful graduates on Genevieve Lacey's amazing Finding Our Voice project. And I am still going to make that podcast. But I got a message in the meantime from one of my fantastic graduates. That graduate is now a music teacher, and I'm not going to name them for obvious reasons, but I did check it was okay that I could just tell you this little anecdote. So he's now a music teacher at a school in Western Sydney with an amazing music program that's been going on for many years. So he's joined a wonderful tradition in this school and a group of very culturally diverse students, including a much higher than average First Nations population. So months ago, this teacher had planned a day to bring his students to come in and see us at the Sydney Conservatorium of Music, where, as most of you know, I lecture in music education, amongst other things such as music technology and composition. And he was bringing his students into the Sydney Con to get an idea of what a music school looked like and to see the kinds of studies that can be done, the many different kinds of music, musical cultures that we nowadays do degrees in, because it's very, very broad from what you might associate with a conservatory model, lots of historical music, classical in inverted commas music, through to a contemporary degree. Lots of jazz, of course, very famous jazz department at the Sydney Con, and some specialist degrees nowadays in, you know, digital music, such as, you know, making, learning how to write film soundtracks and things like that. So his students were coming in. They were also going to meet some of our students and some of the staff and hopefully give them the idea that coming and studying with us at the Sydney Con is an achievable aspiration. You know, the only thing that's stopping you is not knowing about it, and or maybe also not doing the hard work that's involved in getting in. But, you know, that first step of making that an aspiration, if after coming and seeing us, that's something that they're interested in. So a day that teacher was really looking forward to and the students were too. Sadly, the trips had to be cancelled because the Department of Education have decided to have a day of professional development on Monday for all teachers, including all music teachers. And the topic for the Professional Development Day is explicit teaching. We've even had the Minister of Education talking about it and how important it is. It's been all over the newspapers. The Minister for Education is also the Deputy Premier, so she's a very high-profile person in the government, and thus this is a high-profile day. And as I say, every department music teacher in this state. So that means lots of my listeners are heading into a day of professional learning on Monday. And as we teachers always do, I remember them well, wondering whether it's useful to them. So luckily, I know an expert on explicit teaching and music education. That particular subject. That's quite a niche part of the explicit teaching world, because he wrote a paper on this topic as part of his PhD. And so I pivoted from the podcast that I was preparing to hastily arrange an interview with my friend and colleague. And I said he wrote this as part of his PhD. So it is with my friend and colleague, Dr. Brad Fuller, because his PhD is in and done now. About that paper. And just to introduce Brad before I cut to that, I heard a wonderful podcast once with somebody who is a mindfulness teacher and went to study with the Dalai Lama and kept taking a research student of theirs with them and introducing them to the Dalai Lama as my research student. And the Dalai Lama, who is obviously not known for physical attacks, hit the professor and said, not my, i.e. you don't own that student, don't refer to them as my student. The wonderful thing about having been the supervisor of Brad's PhD was that I definitely learned loads more than he learned, or at least I learned everything that he learned, and I definitely learned loads more from him than he learned from me. I'm sure if you follow his podcast through the gig-based learning website and stuff like that, he'll tell you a little bit more about his story there on their, I think they call it their blog cast. But Brad pivoted from really being focused on music technology, which is still one of his specialties. So we have a lot of crossover in what we're interested in, and looking at exactly where music education is in the politics and the ideology and the the pressures that are placed on music teachers today. The PhD is a fantastic read. It's got four different papers and book chapters that he had published as part of it, and then he puts the whole thing together. And I mentioned a week or two ago that I'm working on a research book at the moment, and Brad is one of my colleagues working on that book, which is actually based on a theory that he developed at the end of that. So an amazing academic, amazing music teacher, amazing thinker, and really fantastic to be able to bring Brad into the podcast for an interview for the first time since series one, something that I certainly hope that I can do again in the future. So here we are, over to the interview. Thanks for coming and chatting to me in Music Zettel, Brad. So your paper is called Is What Works Best, Best for Music Education? But what does that have to do with explicit teaching?
Well, if you believe everything you read in the What Works Best 2014 and What Works Best, I think, 2020, turns out number one or number two on the hit list of what works best is explicit teaching. And or sometimes it's sometimes called explicit teaching, sometimes called explicit instruction, and sometimes called direct instruction. And all of those things mean slightly different things, but in general discourse, they're used interchangeably. And so I think in New South Wales at the moment, explicit teaching was what works best in 2020. Sometimes, though, I think it's called explicit instruction in the media. And what is it that's happening, James, in New South Wales this coming Monday?
Ah, yes. Well, our music teachers, I mean, they're all teachers, but we're concerned about music teachers because we're on Music Zettel. They're all going to be doing this day of professional development about explicit teaching. So there's a relation between that, and you mentioned two documents called What Works Best. So they're specifically things here in New South Wales in Australia, but probably some of our listeners around the world have heard of ideas like What Works Best before, do we think?
Yes, in other jurisdictions, governments and independent, that's in quotes, independent bodies use the term What Works. But when we brought What Works, imported it from England in about, 2012 or so, we decided to pop Best on the end. It wasn't just What Works, it's What Works Best. And so there was a particular government body was formed, and they published this paper called What Works Best in 2014, and then a paper called What Works Best Update in 2020. That's the Centre for Education Statistics and Evaluation, or CSEES. And so they came up with eight, and I've called them themes, practices, or strategies, because they use those terms interchangeably throughout the document. And so their eight were: number one, high expectations; number two, explicit teaching; number three, effective feedback; four, use of data to inform practice; five, assessment; six, classroom management; seven, well-being; and eight, collaboration.
Well, so those all sound like excellent things for teachers to do, all of those things.
So there you are, number two on the hit list, explicit teaching.
Right. Okay, so we've had that. That's been one of the eight golden things, or the seven golden things, since 2014. So you would think that we're already really good at it and that we all know what it is. But just in case anyone has never heard of explicit teaching or those other kind of versions of it that you were talking about, like direct instruction, what does it actually mean?
So CSEES adopted Hattie's definition in 2020, and they said, explicit teaching is where, quote, the teacher decides the learning intentions and success criteria, makes them transparent to the students, demonstrates them by modelling, evaluates if they understand what they've been told by checking for understanding, and retelling them what they've been told by tying it all together with closure.
Oh, that's funny, because I would just call that didactic education.
It was, yes. Yeah. Up until somebody came up with a new name for it, mostly it was called chalk and talk.
Yeah, chalk and talk. Yeah, which is fine. We all chalk and talk. Probably a bit too much, don't we? I love chalking and talking.
Well, that was the thing for a while, wasn't it? Was trying to convince teachers to talk less.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was the prevailing discourse for a while.
Yeah.
And now it's, actually talk more.
Okay. So this is right. Okay. So that's interesting, right? Because I would think in music education, I still find when I go and watch my Pracky students, I still find that I'm asking them to talk less and just do music more. So I'm going to guess, I mean, I have actually already read your paper, but I'm not going to take any spoilers. I'm going to guess that you didn't necessarily find that this is a good direction to take music education in. Am I right in your research?
Well, interestingly, it wasn't just me. Paulo Freire, in 1970, essentially paraphrased what John Hattie said in 2009, but as a criticism rather than a direction for how teachers might like to teach. Can I read that to you?
I'd love it.
Check this out. So he calls Freire's explanation, no, Freire's definition. So Freire's term for explicit teaching is the banking concept of education. And he says, this is in which education thus becomes an act of depositing, in which the students are the depositories and the teacher is the depositor. Instead of communicating, the teacher issues communiques and makes deposits which the students patiently receive, memorize, and repeat. That's from page 72. isn't that interesting that that was a criticism and it sounds almost exactly like a description of explicit teaching?
Yeah, that's really interesting. Okay, so go on. I'll leave my question hanging. That's what Frary thinks, and that's about all education. What did you and others find about music education?
Well, so our music education is built on, three learning experiences. And in New South Wales, in Music Year 7 to 10, we talk about teachers providing opportunities for students to have experiences. And those experiences are performing, composing, and listening. Notice I emphasized ing because they are doing words. So our mandated curriculum in New South Wales is about students having opportunities to experience music, to have musical experiences, and rather than the teacher telling them about music, the syllabus is designed for students to experience music.
Fantastic. I'm just going to let you keep going because, so I can see that there's a clash there in the intention of the syllabus and this guidance that the teacher needs to tell the students what they need to know and then help them practice it until they know it.
Yeah, and so essentially we've set up a dichotomy, I think, because what works best is essentially grounded in behavioralist and cognitivist learning theories. And so they're coming from an objective perspective or epistemology. And so the music education is based on a constructivist understanding. And so in words like experience, we can see come from scholars like John Dewey, who has a book called Art and Experience. And Dewey's whole approach was about learning through experiencing. And so right from the get-go, we've got our syllabus, which is based on a pragmatic constructivist underpinning, coming up against this new mandate, government top-down mandate, which has a completely opposite epistemology based on behaviorist, and we hear lots and lots about the science of learning and about cognitive load, and essentially that comes from what philosophers and learning people talk about as an objectivist epistemology. So it seems to me that we've got a problem.
It's really interesting, right? And I don't know, Brad, whether you're completely up to date with your episodes, but I did do a few. I did talk a little bit about our new upcoming syllabus and talked about the fact that, you know, there's lots of interesting things happening with syllabus reform around the country. Around the world at the moment that affects music teachers and music education. But it seems to me like even though I made a whole episode moaning about having 56 points to check off in the new syllabus that's been published, I very much praised the spirit of the new syllabus and the fact that it did and does still have essentially, in the main part, those same sort of constructivist underpinnings. So it's interesting because that tension that you're pointing out here between the idea of students learning music through experiencing music and the direction of using a more explicit teaching approach is that both of those instructions are coming from government. In one case, coming from the syllabus goes to all schools, but the explicit teaching thing more specifically into teachers in department schools. It's teachers in department schools who'll have to do this training on Mondays. Teachers in Catholic schools and independent schools, it's a kind of optional thing for them, isn't it, whether they look at the advice that's coming from CC. But yeah, interesting that tension, actually, it's not a tension between teachers and between government or between, I know it's been painted in the press as a tension between academics and government, but it's actually a tension between two government documents, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredible. I'll give you an example. So the Music 7 to 10 syllabus on page 18. Check this out. It says, learning in music, ready, occurs best. So what works best, according to our syllabus, right? What works best is learning in music occurs best when these experiences, performing, composing, listening, are integrated with each other. So integrated learning experiences. And then if we look at the what works best document, it says, the evidence shows that students who experience explicit teaching practices perform better than students who do not.
Right.
So we've got both documents there very clearly pronouncing an empirical statement.
Mm.
Might
the problem there be performed though, Brad, because students perform best after explicit teaching. So this is designed for all teachers in all subjects, not just music teachers. So perform, therefore, might be answering questions in a test or an exam.
That's fantastic. Okay, so we've got a syllabus who's saying learning in music occurs best because it's concerned with learning. And we've got this what works best document. Yes, that's fantastic. Dr. Humberstone, well done. That's all about performing and in a competitive student versus student, and it's not about learning it at all. It's about ranking. That's very good. Something's even more scary is in what works best when it says consistent use of explicit teaching practices, and it's all about everybody in the school doing it the same way, regardless of, well, the subject at hand.
Hmm.
What is the music teacher to do? And that, I guess that's where I came in with this paper, being really concerned for myself as a music teacher, but for music teachers in New South Wales who were experiencing this cognitive dissonance where is it rabbit season or duck season, essentially? What do I do?
Yeah, fantastic. And I'll just remind our listeners of the name of the paper again. I'd said it in my first question, but you'll realise how clever it is now. Is what works best for music education and best for music educators and maybe best for students in the music classroom? So we're talking about a document and a series of strategies from the government of things that have been shown according to the research that they cite to be the things that are best. But Brad's proposition is, that these might be good things across the board or they might not be, but let's think specifically about music education. And again, just I'm going to ask Brad in a second. He's got a fantastic quote from a scholar called Bennett Riemer, one of the most influential music scholars who's lived, especially in America. The tension that I wonder there about the teacher talking is, if we take ourselves away from classroom music education, so I ask you, while I give Brad a second to think about Bennett Riemer, I ask you to think about, how you learned music, how you learned to play your instrument, how you learned to sing in choir, how you learned to rock out, how you learn to make music in the studio, and you think about that, even the time that you spent directly with teachers or mentors is all about you learning. I don't think that this is some sort of crazy hippie idea, this idea that musicians learn by doing, especially when we think about learning to play instruments and learning to make music, all of the active musicking stuff. It is something that we do very hands-on. So have you got that quote from Bennett Riemer? Because I think that allows us to make that distinction between classroom music education nicely, doesn't it?
Indeed. And I have a blog post about Bennett Riemer. He's one of my cats of music education because he literally wrote the book on it. In 1970, he wrote the worst... In 1970, he wrote the first music education philosophy.
I'm leaving worst in.
Thank you. And so he kept updating that. And in 2003, he wrote the third edition of his Music Education Philosophy. And so he had, at that point, about 30 years working on what he talked about as the language knowing paradigm. And he says, language knowing is so dominant in education, so highly respected and supported, that we can be seduced into relying on it too much, overbalancing the experiential foundation our subject requires. So we need to be careful here. Thank you, Bennett. Using disclosure and explanation sufficiently for them to enrich, but sparingly enough that they do not interfere with what matters most in music, the experience of its meaningfully organized sounds in their embodiment of the culture from which they spring.
Holy moly.
Yep.
Yeah, that's really good, isn't it?
That's beautiful?
Really good. And he's bringing it back to that work experience, which is the word that you got out of the syllabus before.
Yes, funny that. That word, enrich, we need to be so careful. So it's not that we're not going to talk about music. We need to be careful, though, and using disclosure and explanation to enrich, but not to interfere. So use sparingly and enrichingly.
On my list of podcasts to make, dear listener, these will all be made in the end. I've got one called Don't Teach the Concepts. And that's that. Sorry, Brad, I know Elliot and Silverman call it verbal knowledge. What does Rima call it?
Language knowing.
Language knowing, yeah. So, and that is literally that idea. I will record that podcast one day. Maybe we should record that one together as well, Brad. But yeah, that idea of don't just teach about music. Teach music itself. Teach music learning. Teach as Rima said, and as the syllabus says, and as Brad said, Dewey said. Teach through the experience of music.
So yeah. So to me, Rima here is saying you're performing, composing, and listening, and then you're disclosing, and I think that's a really important word too. It's not just explaining, but it's disclosing as well, and I love that word. It's like you've kept something up your sleeve and the students are musicking, and then an opportunity presents itself to talk, and then you can disclose something that will be much more enriching because the students have the experience, and then the disclosure comes after the experience, and it's so much more useful than the before when nobody cares about it yet.
It reminds me of one of the things you told me about. I think, it's from Elliot and Silverman, about that the teacher fades in and then fades out. So that's nice, isn't it? You might fade in and do a bit of disclosing.
Yeah, and I think it works really well with Lucy Green's informal learning research, where the students would talk about the teacher standing outside the room, and when we need them, they'd help us.
So you were saying before, Brad, that we're sort of set up with a dichotomy here, but one of the things that, you know, as somebody who would definitely describe himself as a constructivist, you know, I'm definitely interested in, and specifically about being a music teacher, not necessarily about all education. I totally accept the fact that, you know, in a subject like maths, especially in the early years, kids just need to repeat doing things with the number ladder until it's internalized. So I'm certainly not against the idea of rote learning, and you know, I totally understand that it has a place. But with that dichotomy, I wonder whether you feel that it does come down to one or the other. So is it explicit teaching or student-centered teaching, or whether there's a balance, and if there's a balance for music education, whether that balance should be prescriptive or whether it's something that the teacher feels out themselves?
Well, I think that's what Rima was getting to keep coming back to Rima, was getting to that there's already a tendency in music education to lean towards what Elliot and Silverman call talk, and more talk. So we've already had, even in the last 20 or 30 years or so, we've had a much more fertile ground for doing through the project management period. Project-based learning period. And with a constructivist, pragmatic music syllabus, teachers have been impelled and encouraged to talk less and let students experience more. And yet, at the same time, Rima's there in 2003 is identifying that compulsion we have as teachers to want to talk. It's a thing, right, for teachers. All right, hush, everybody, I'm an expert. Yeah. And can we cut to the chase? You could faff around doing it improperly, but just sit quietly for a minute and I'll tell you the answers.
Yeah.
I think it's important. That's certainly within me. I'd love everybody to sit quietly and me to tell them to do it the right way.
Especially when the students end up in our wheelhouse. Like if they suddenly end up, you know, doing it like with me, it would obviously be composing, songwriting, that kind of thing. Like I've done this a million times. Let me share some golden nuggets. I definitely feel like that.
And I think it can come from a really nice place too. I found this all, like, for example, I found this all really difficult. Let me give you the shortcuts. I think it all comes from a nice place. But I think a not so nice place is this thing that we have with music education, the profession always feeling like it's under attack in schools. And you've talked about this a great deal, about how many schools and how many students don't have access to a great music education or any music education in the classroom. And funding cuts, and there are movies about it and all sorts of stuff. So one of the ways typically that music education and music teachers try to deal with that is through what a writer called Luth calls the legitimation crisis. And he says in that it's all about us trying to say, look, we're just as rigorous as you. Check this out, maths. We do lots of talking and writing and rote learning as well. And we've got a written examination and we can do multiple choices as well. So this legitimation crisis already kind of impels us and compels us as music teachers to go, yeah, we're just as legit as you are. And we're kind of forced into playing in this field, which isn't our field. We've got something much richer and cooler and hipper to offer, which is these musical experiences of performing, composing and listening, which are in and of themselves wonderful. And that's what our profession and that's what music has to offer. But we can be fooled into playing along in this legitimation crisis, into saying, look at us. Luth talks about objective assessment-driven instruction. And then if you, even scarier, I think, if you look at the research that Snyder and Roll did in 2007, they said that teachers tend to be atheoretical and inconsistent in their beliefs, with experienced teachers more likely to favour teacher-centred teaching, and that constructivist beliefs of pre-service teachers and beginning teachers tend to temper over time as they become immersed in the culture of teaching.
Wow.
So there's quite a good deal of pressure, and so for us both to have been involved for years with pre-service and in-service teachers, my heart particularly goes out to the young teachers who are just feeling torn between what might feel natural and right to them versus this legitimation crisis where we're being told across the state that students perform best when they're talked at.
I mean, that's absolutely fascinating, isn't it? Thinking about, you know, the graduates that we've had from the last 5 years, if they spend 4 years in the degree and following Nessa's own recommendations, every single lecture is based on the last 10 years
research. So everything is completely and utterly research-backed or evidence-based, if you prefer. And of course, also culturally diverse, because we really try to teach music in a pluralist way, so that the ideas are either transferable, or where we need to be culturally sensitive, that we are learning how to investigate and be culturally responsive. That's the term that I'm trying to find. So to then go from that, and having learned from all of the latest research, to an idea that seems to me like not necessarily a bad idea, but an idea that is just generally aimed towards everybody, but wasn't actually, you know, based necessarily on research that had anything to do with music education at all.
Indeed. And that's, I think that's the scary thing, that coming back to that quote about from that research from Snyder and Roll, where it's a drift. There's a natural drift towards more talk. The longer you teach, the more likely you are to talk. And now that's being actively encouraged. I think that's just a really scary moment.
Yeah, and let's make it really clear at this point that we're not. We're not actually, you know, accusing our most experienced teachers out there of all being painful chalk and talkers. I know certainly that all the mentors that I had, who were, as our friend Jenny Robinson calls, veteran teachers, or even super veteran teachers, which actually includes you and me, Brad. Are we veteran or super veteran? I think we're veteran for about another 5 years, and then we're super veteran. But certainly, yeah, I can remember being blown away going into watch lessons where an experienced teacher leads an ensemble playing, or leads a group singing, or leads a songwriting challenge, and, you know, bring everybody together, get them going, leave the students going, and just plucking little moments of learning out and making sure that everyone's aware of them throughout. And hardly, you know, if we had a percentage on it, you know, the teacher isn't even the center of attention for more than 5% of the class, but learning is constantly happening. The teacher's definitely in control. But yes, I hear you very much. I don't know. Do you want to tell us anything else about explicit teaching? Because I know that you ended up getting onto a recommendation at the end, and I want to make sure we get there before we finish.
So I think it's really important then. Well, okay, so we have to find a way forward, don't we? Because everybody in New South Wales on Monday of next week, depending on when this podcast hits the listeners'
tomorrow.
Ears.
Yeah,
everybody's going to be sitting in the room. So
if they're in a department school, yes,
we've never in music education been not about explicitly instructing people. It's being careful, though. I think we just have to keep coming back to Rima. We need to be careful here. Using disclosure and explanation sufficiently for them to enrich, but not to interfere. And so I think that's where, and also maybe if we pick up Wayne Bowman's work in 2005, he called explicit instruction a do-it-this-way mode. And sure, there are times as a musician where it's really helpful for somebody to say, do it this way. But how often in music is it magical when somebody finds a new way to do it? And so I think that gets us to Dewey's wonderful work about being welcomed into a tradition. And so to have the tradition saying, this is everything that's happened before you got here, and now choose your own adventure. And so I think in that way, explicit instruction, as long as it tells us, can help to tell us what we might do, it can help to understand what somebody has done. But we have to be very careful that it's not that music education doesn't become a do it this way approach. And so, and because I think this is beautiful, but from Bowman, he talks about. if not carefully monitored, foster critical compliance and nurture dependence. Isn't that, that's a beautiful phrase, critical compliance and nurture dependence, rather than the independence and empowerment that are hallmarks of true education. And so, and coming back to Freire again, he talks about narration sickness. I love that. And I've looked out at my students over the years and definitely seen some people a bit green around the gills as I've been rabbiting on with some wonderful exposition.
We've all been there.
And so Freire says, get this, the real evil is not in the expository lesson, in the explanation given by the teacher, but he argues for an approach which he regards as profoundly valid. So that's pretty cool. So explicit instruction can be profoundly valid. But he says where the teacher makes little presentations of the subject and then, get this, the group of students joins with the teacher in an analysis precisely of that presentation. And so I think that's really important, because when we're talking, we're not talking at, we're talking with, and we're giving everybody the opportunity to think critically about what we're doing. So I guess what I'm saying here is that we're experiencing music, we're doing music from time to time. Anybody in the room might want to talk about what we're doing. That might be the teacher, but I'd argue that students could make really wonderful observations and bring all sorts of rich musical backgrounds to the classroom. And to have an exposition where we can all challenge ourselves and grow.
I mean, I really love that, and I want to actually acknowledge that in some of the explicit teaching and direct instruction literature, there are researchers who've talked very much about, you know, the waiting between the teacher talking and the students discussing and analysing. So it is, you know, if Brad and I are both saying this isn't a dichotomy, it's not one or the other, then that's true. But I also want to recognize that Freire is talking about there, as is the explicit teaching, is talking about that verbal knowledge, is talking about, you know, about the words of music, and music is all about words.
And I think... Then Elliot and Silverman in 2015 came along and they said, this is beautiful, verbal dialogues. I love that. Verbal dialogues. That's feels democratic, and that is even hipper than conversation. So verbal dialogues contribute to, but should never replace, active musicking and listening. They say verbal concepts and conversations about musical products and music making, this is really beautiful, are filtered in parenthetically and contextually, and should emerge from and be discussed in relation to ongoing efforts to solve musical problems through active musicking and listening.
And there, ladies and gentlemen, is what I was just trying to say, but actually in really good words that are very understandable. That's excellent.
And I think they also go on, they talk about educative teaching, which is educative teaching is all about care and growth of the student, and is so different from the idea of the student performing. As we heard before, it's actually about learning and growth and empowerment. And so they talk about educative teaching involves taking short time outs. And I love the idea of explicit instruction being a time out that comes out of the musicking. Yeah. And they say it might be now and then you might ask brief closed-ended and open-ended questions about anything related to the expressive nature of their musicking, what they're thinking or feeling about their what they're doing, or to provide some amount of musical contextual information or suggestions that will deepen students' awareness of how to play, sing or compose more expressively, or to give them a chance to contribute their own constructive suggestions about why and how to make their music more creative, to collaborate with each other about how to generate and select imaginative ideas for various parts of a composition, and so forth. So here the explicit instruction is so far removed of what we were talking about before about Bowman's Okay, everybody sit quietly and I'll tell you this. We're going to do it this way mode, and this is how you do it.
I love that so much because I know what it's like when you get a, because I've done them myself. When I was a classroom teacher, I did classroom teaching for 12 years. So I did my fair share of staff days, and you rock up to the staff day and you haven't really thought about it beforehand unless you've been sent some homework to do. You're just sort of sitting there thinking, how on earth is this going to be relevant to me? Well, dear music teachers, if you are doing this kind of professional development on Monday or any other time of your careers, you can take that advice. You are learning about how to do useful brief timeouts from musicking. These are brief. You are learning excellent skills for what you might do in your brief timeouts from musicking. That's beautiful. So musicking is still the main course. In fact, it's probably still the starter, main course, and the dessert. But between those courses, you may have some brief timeout, and maybe some explicit teaching. It would be a good thing to do then. That's fantastic, isn't it?
Some parenthetical explicit instruction.
Yes.
Well, in What Works Best is What Works Best for Music Education, I argue then that, and we can temper this, I'm not sure that teachers want to put their hand up and say, Fuller says that we should be engaged in explicit learning, but you could have this up your sleeve. So what I'm working on in my practice is rather than explicit teaching, to have explicit learning. And so in my paper, I argue for teacher as learner, and to make your learning with the students explicit and talk them through, essentially give them a commentary about how the teacher is approaching learning as a musician and how that happens organically in the classroom with the students. And that comes again inspired by Freire. So he talks about an active dialogic music classroom. Well, I put the word music classroom in there. So he talks about the bank clerk or clerk, music teacher, who can transform into, a musician in the classroom. And so this is this is enough from me. I'll give you this quote and you can take it away and have a think. So he says, going from the bank clerk / clerk who explicitly teaches to a musician who explicitly learns. And Freire paints a picture of, quote, a very serious teacher who adopts a relationship with the subject, with the content, that is one of profound, affectionate, almost loving respect. This passionate classroom music teacher is bearing witness to the students as to how he or she studies, approaches, or draws near a given subject, how she or he thinks critically. Students in this classroom are also transformed as the teacher's explicit learning impels them to have or create and develop the critical ability to accompany the teacher's movement in his or her attempt to approach the topic under consideration. Thank you, Paolo. And just a couple of little inserts there in square brackets of music teacher. But he laid it all down for us, you know, between 1970 and about 2000 and something.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Explicit learning, everybody. We've already worked out that explicit teaching is going to be excellent for our brief timeouts. But generally, if we want to have an approach that works for us in music education and maybe philosophically a little bit with the way music is learned, explicit learning and sharing that process of learning with our students might be the way to go. According to the paper by Dr. Brad Fuller, is What Works Best for Music Education. Brad, the listeners might want to go and listen to your In Competition With Mine podcast, because we do duke it out in the podcast airwaves, and also can read some of what you've written and join a community that you run called Gig Based Learning. Where would they go to find out about that?
You could just point your browser to Gig Based Learning, or your if you type that into a search box anywhere. I think Peter Orensteiner are the only people that come up at the moment. So there's a what we call a blog cast on Substack. It's available on Spotify and Apple Music, and it's also a website and a YouTube channel. But maybe a great place, if this has made you think, oh, that's interesting, then the podcast might be a really great place to start. I dig into some of the background that got me into this way of thinking, and there'll be plenty more to come. So, yeah, gig-based learning.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And I did promise the listeners that in the rest of this season, what remains of it, I was going to lean into research a little bit more. And so there we go. We've dealt with what's happening live in Australia at the moment in music education and the influence of politics, and I may even dare to say political ideology a little bit. But we've also responded to that by leaning into some of the latest research evidence. This paper was only published last year, and we've actually spoken to the researcher. So thanks for listening to Music Zettle, and thank you, Brad Fuller, for being my guest.
Thank you very much, Dr. Humberstone. Until next time.
Music Zettle was written, presented, and produced by James Humberstone. Music in this episode was composed by James Humberstone.